So, our main speaker, I want to welcome Kevin Kay to the podium. Come on up. Let's give him a round, huh?
Kevin, alcoholic.
Thank you, Glenn, for asking me to do this. When Glenn asked me, I responded back in a messenger, you know, it would be my pleasure. And today I respond like that, a lot of times without thought, because what I've learned around Alcoholics Anonymous is a beautiful thing that I can respond truthfully. And that's how I feel. I feel grateful. I feel a tremendous amount of gratitude. And I also feel a responsibility to Alcoholics Anonymous when I am asked to do something that's kind of out of the norm, and speaking definitely for me and a group of my peers of alcoholics is definitely out of my norm. But, it's taken me 25 years to get more comfortable with that. First off, I really want to welcome Dorothy and Wendy. One thing, you might have to go out to your car and get your hip waders, because it might get deep in here with the bullshit and the tears. There might be a little bit of the tears in there. The end result for me has been, I hate when I do this, but I can't help it. Alcoholics Anonymous is a tremendous spiritual healing for me on a daily basis that I have the privilege of doing. Damn, this is early on. So the housekeeping, my original sobriety date was 12/27/94. I stayed sober for 12 and a half years. Definitely get to that. And my new sobriety date is 6/21/16. Man, a lot of thoughts and emotions go through my head. What comes to mind is my ego. I let that, and still do to some extent, rule my life. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous and a God that I have met on my terms of acceptance through Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to see those realities. And, that's a reality, self-truth. For me, it's almost an impossible daily chunk of truth and reality to consume. Without this program, obviously you would definitely have a different speaker tonight. I'll get into the gratitude stuff in a bit, but to start out with, my upbringing was similar to a lot of people that I've heard around Alcoholics Anonymous, and also different. And that's repeatedly confirmed to me that alcohol, drugs is a part of my story, is an equalizer. It doesn't care who you think you are, where you came from, what your upbringing is, your parents, etc. It will destroy you slowly but surely. And in our literature it says, some of us could have stopped in time. You know, and I've reflected on that many, many times. And, you know, the program was put in front of me at a very early age. I can recall about 7 years old when I used to go with my mom to the Manhattan Beach Alano Club. You know, and I remember the people there were different from what I was used to interacting with, different adults. I had no idea the tragedies that they had experienced. I didn't really understand what that word meant at that time, even though I was going through my own. But I do remember, you know, them being really nice. And when I would go with my mom and my stepdad to the bars, and we would be in the parking lot with my brother and sister in the car, different drunks would bring out chips, popcorn, soda, sometimes with a cherry on it. And man, that was just the shit. And then they'd go back in the bar. And this would happen, especially on the weekends, starting in the afternoon at some point, and continuing sometimes till the bar closed. But they would leave. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I sensed at that time that these were maybe some of the same kind of people, because a couple of them I did see at the bar, and I also seen them at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was kind of, I didn't really dwell on it, but I do remember thinking that. And the people, when I would go into the room with my mom at the Alano Club, you know, there's a little place where you sit on a little couch or whatnot and play some games. Popcorn, chips, soda. But they would also come over and talk with me. And an adult talking to me, already at that point, I was extremely leery of any big people, because they'd all fucked me over really bad. You know, and if they didn't, there certainly wasn't any love and compassion. Not that I knew what that meant at that time, but I was kind of recognizing good people, bad people. And that's kind of the thinking that I grew up with, you know. You know, and reflecting back on that, that's a fucked up place to be, you know. And, you know, I still have a tremendous amount of healing to do in there. And it's not about the forgiveness part. I think that's been long over, you know, and I've gotten that through different things that I've heard throughout life. You know, don't judge unless you be judged. You know, I heard that, and with the shit I've done in my life, I got no room to stand on whatsoever at all. And you know, the 12 steps has helped me get through that little by little, slow as fuck. And I'm an impatient person. You know, I want instant results. That's one reason why my drinking escalated to where it was. I want instant results. I want to be numb. I don't want to feel. And I want to do it again and again, because I have to. Because when I'm left with myself, that's my only option. And then I reach the point where, jumping off point, you know, I can't imagine, you know, I can't imagine life with alcohol or without it. You know, that's my only, not even friend at that point, but companion, my road dog, ride or die. What the fuck is up with that, man? You know, that's a reality that I've come to know for myself as fact. Another big truth to swallow, you know, because, you know, when I'm going hard on all cylinders, I don't care what anybody says. I know everybody loves me, right? Whether I'm drinking or not, but especially when I got a couple cocktails in me, I can do no wrong. You know, my ego just, it has ruled and consumed my life. And the destroying part, yeah, a little bit. you know. But I believe God, throughout my life, has brought me back down to a grounding. And for me, that grounding has not been church. I've tried church, and I'm not knocking church or any religion. You know, it says in our book, look to where, you know, our religious leaders are right. And I believe that we get certain things in our life at certain times that benefit us or that can benefit us. Whether we pick them up or not, it's our choice. And for me, the choices that I've made been guided to by God, I believe, back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to pick these up again. And, you know, coming back to that door repeatedly over and over and over is just a, for me, an extremely huge and humbling endeavor. When I'm honest about it, when I'm not putting the face on, when I'm not lying, I've done that many times. You know, and whatever I say up here, you know, it's just my experience. You know, I think a lot of us, you know, when we share or speak or whatever, especially if we're asked in advance to speak, we get the brain cells going and refer to the book and try to think of everything that's great that everybody wants to hear because we want to be loved and liked. And I am definitely a poster child for that. But I diffuse that, you know, that's hard to do, but I do diffuse it. My very first sponsor, I was a 10-minute speaker at a pretty damn large meeting, and there's about 400 people there, and I'm like, dude, okay, he's like, well, you got to do it, and it's like he's fishing and bringing me in little by little, and I said, yeah, but Mike, dude, I don't have any experience, I really don't know what I'm talking about, you know, and I said, you know, I bullshit all day long. He goes, oh, no, all you have to do is tell the truth. That's it. And I certainly have enough history with Alcoholics Anonymous to have ample supply of truth. And, you know, that saying, the truth will set you free. I found that to be very relevant in my life. And it's for me, it's getting to the truth. And not necessarily always my perception of that. So I get to do what it says in the back of the book. It's one of my very favorite pages in there. And, you know, the honesty, the willingness, and the open-mindedness in the spiritual experience in Appendix 2 and back of the book, 578, something like that. And, you know, honesty, willingness, open-mindedness. That this time around has been key to me. I can always, no matter what the situation is, I can always refer back to that and get at least a little tiny bit of guidance and direction where to go, along with the prayer, you know. Lord, you know, help me to be honest, open-minded, and willing. And all three of those in different situations are very difficult. Especially the willingness, you know, because I can say, yeah, I'm going to be honest, I'm going to be open-minded, but am I willing really to take that action to do that? And that's a trudge, you know, that's a real trudge for me, because as I do that, I get the benefits of learning more about myself, and the end result is comfort. I get comfort and I get peace when I'm accepting of those results that I discover. It's hard to go through, but when I get on the other side, like a lot of problems we go to, we blow it up. We really blow it up. And my ego helps me do that. When I get on the other side of that, I experience that peace and comfort. And I think back and I'm like, God, dude, wow. Why do you do that? You know? And I don't know why. I don't know. I prayed for that to go away. Will it ever? I don't know that it will. Has it been beneficial to me in certain cases in my life? Yeah, it has. It has been a safety net a few times, and also like the danger, stranger thing. You know, it's helped keep me out of messes too. And that's what I try to do today. You know, Robert T. says, you know, don't hurt the nice people, you know. And to me, that always meant don't go cut their throat, put a bullet in their head, or beat the shit out of them. Yeah. And today, that takes on a different meaning that I've gotten to receive through Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is be conscious of other people's feelings, what I say to them, because I'm pretty damn sarcastic at times. And it's been pointed out to me by very few people, but a few people that I do respect in these rooms, and to maybe tone it down a bit. And that, you know, that helps put me in check. Because that's not something that I'm open to hearing generally. Yeah. So, anyways, growing up, life was a hellhole. Both my parents were heavy-duty alcoholics. My stepfather, from 2 years to 10 years, was a raging fucking alcoholic, heroin-dealing motherfucker. Have I forgiven him? Absolutely. And it was for some other reasons, but the bottom line is I hold good with that. I don't need to dwell on it. Do I think that he or them or those is the reason I became such a raging fucking asshole alcoholic? No, and I'm still searching for those answers. I just know today that I don't want what I had, you know, and so I have to be the willing part, willing to change, willing to try something different, willing and be open-minded to when I'm sitting in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous to really try and set aside my bias, I hate to say it, hatred for some people. It's the closest thing that I can come to, I don't like you. And that's a sickness. Does it make me feel better and comfortable? For a brief second sometimes. But really, I get to look at myself after the meeting, and I've heard other people reflect, and that I've heard them share, I believe, as God speaks to us in our group conscience, and realize, oh, dude, you are sick, man. And the feeling that I'm left with is an emptiness, but also a little bit of knowledge that I can chew on for a while and try not to repeat those thoughts and those which lead to sometimes actions. Up to the age of 10, life was unbelievable. It was fucking unbelievable, the shit that went on. I mean, it used to be normal when we'd have block parties in Redondo Beach, California, in the South Bay. 4th of July in particular, they would shut the whole block down. We had three cops that lived, Redondo Beach cops that lived in our block. And this is in the 70s, early 70s. And it was on and cracking. And anything went. And as the day got longer, it started, you know, 11, 10 o'clock in the morning. And kind of where the sun went down, and maybe just a little bit after it, maybe I'd say the 8 to 10 o'clock hour, shit got live. And you'd hear the woohoo, woohoo, ah, 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 boom, smack, bang. I mean, I'm like, oh, that's not fireworks over there. Oh, Mr. Jones is beating the fuck out of Mrs. Jones again. Mr. Smith's doing it to, hey, that's a policeman doing that to his wife. He's not supposed to do that. And fucking people are starting to take naps on lawns and shit. What the fuck? And the dogs are pissing on the porch, and that's okay. And you know, all these weird things. And I really, honestly, didn't think it was all crazy. Nah, fuck, that's just, I didn't give it any thought, really. Just kind of the way it was, you know? I thought it was kind of weird that the cops beat the fuck out of their old ladies, instead of rescuing the other ones, but I'm just riding my bike. And seeing what I could snatch, you know, fireworks. And clean up. I always get it cleaning up. I specifically remember doing cleanup detail. That was kind of my job. Just make sure that the empties are gone off the porch. And so I did that with my buddy Bubba, my best friend next door from Texas. And his dad was a trash man. He used to go and bring home sheets and stuff. We make these forts. And Bubba's sister and myself, we were about 7, 8. And we had a fence this high, chain link fence between our houses, and it was perfect for the canopy or our thing. And we'd put rocks down there and tie the sheets together and make our little tents, because the day after 4th of July, you know, the morning after, people are coming to and mulling about. And all the ladies, our house and Bubba's house was kind of the hangout for all the women to come there. And in the 70s, you know, you remember they had those killer big old glasses, and they all had them on. And every once in a while, I get a side glimpse, you know, and Miss Jones had a big old shiner right here, and so did Miss Smith, my mom. And, I guess that's what it is, you know. They sit around and they commiserate, and we kind of started to catch on that things maybe weren't right. And then we'd go out and have our own little powwows, our own little like, oh, my mom got beat up and my mom too. And we'd be out in our fort, you know. And that seemed, I guess, kind of normal. I don't give it much thought that it wasn't, you know. But children are in a little makeshift tent, and they're sitting there crying about how fucked up the 4th of July was, basically. That's not normal. And there was many, 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 many stories, occasions, events like that that happened up to the age of 10. So when I discovered alcohol, and it was at one of those kind of block parties, but I don't remember really feeling anything from it. Maybe I didn't have enough. I don't know. But I do remember at 9.5 years old, my mom, she had enough of the shit. She was very naive and a real good girl at that point. And she left. You know, one day she was just gone. And about 2.5 weeks went by, and I was up with my younger brother and my younger sister and myself and my stepdad in the house. And it was a continued ass beating every day. So that was nothing different. But my mom wasn't there to protect me and get her ass beating in the process. So I just had enough. I had to go. I got on my bike and I rode away, and I knew where the bars were at down in Artesia Boulevard. So I rode down there, and that was about, at least 5 miles. And 9.5, so I did that truck, and I found her in a bar, and she was with this guy, Gentle Ben. You know, everybody's got Grinder Joe, Gentle Ben, Plumber Pete, and went to their house, and I was hiding out there, and my sister and brother ratted me out, my stepdad was a major fighter bruiser. I remember in the parking lot of the Thirsty Club, he was slinging about 10, 12 cops off like flies, and they were beating the shit out of him with clubs, and they didn't have tasers in, but they were just going at it right there in the parking lot. And so he loved to get down, and I was just petrified of him. And they showed up at the apartment building somehow. He found out where it was at, and I hear my brother and sister out the bedroom window. They're like, Kevin. I'm like, oh, what the fuck, no. Man, I mean, and my heart could have jumped out of my chest 100 feet easily. And I took out the front door. My mom and Gentle Ben wasn't there. And so I ran out the door, and I was scaling like 6-foot fences. Looking back, I'm like, how the fuck did you do that? Like nothing, man. And I went like 3 blocks through backyards and side yards and scaling these fences, you know, and escaped. And at some point within a day or so, Child Services was called. And they snatched me up and stuck me into a foster home. And my mom's drinking took off like wildfire. We all got snatched up and put into different foster homes. They tried to keep my brother and I together, and that worked for a little bit. His dad got him back because that was his real father. And by that time, he had found some nurse gal or something, started some sick relationship, And my sister was crazy as a shithouse rat. She still is to this day. And there was no, I don't even know the number. It was way more than 10 foster homes. She was just the full-on definition of an incorrigible child. And she ended up in a girl's home in Pasadena, which was insane. And I went to this foster home in Torrance, California. And for the first time in my life, I experienced true, non-judgmental, caring, loving adults in my life on a consistent daily basis. I don't know that I thought and I died and went to heaven, but I wasn't living the existence anymore that I was. And that's all it was an existence. It certainly wasn't a life. It was just a torturous hell. And these people were so nice, and I started to do things that I never even knew existed. And it was great for about 2.5 years. And at that point, my mom was diagnosed with cirrhosis. She was headed towards her deathbed. And at that time, that was her option. She couldn't quit drinking. And even with all that in light and all the promises and everything, and she couldn't do it. And so she signed me away for adoption. And I found out years later, after I was 18, that my real father, my biological father, they had to track him down in Pennsylvania to get him to sign the papers. And he reluctantly did it. He wanted me back. He wanted to take me back there. He had started a family, never seen my biological father ever to this day. And he wanted me back, and the social worker people told him that it would be too traumatic for me to make that transfer. And I still look back at that and just scratch my head. So it didn't happen. So I was put up for adoption, and you know, I thought, wow, I'm finally going to have a family who's loving and caring. And you know, you're 12 and a half years old. It's not like there's a lot of loving families out there who want to take damaged kids. And I didn't know that then, but I certainly know it now. And they found a professor, well-educated man, big house on the hill, all the bells and whistles in life, and well acquainted with younger folks. And so he adopted me. And we were about 8 months into it, and I came to the realization that the kind of love that he was offering me wasn't cool. I don't know that I knew right from wrong. I just knew that I had somebody who was loving me, you know, and that was something different. And that part of it felt right to me. And I endured that abuse for 8 months. And in that time, I had a beautiful girlfriend, Carol Murray, and blonde, and just cute and just great in every way. And I started fooling around with Carol, and I was thinking, yeah, I like this. And I was thinking, like, what's going on at home? And I'm like, So I got on my bike and I did what I do best. I rode off. And I went down to try to find my mom, not understanding the whole situation entirely, down to the Boulevard bars again, and there she was, almost dead. Found her, and she's like, I love you, but you can't be here. You know, I signed you up for adoption. They found a dad that you always wanted, and everybody's happy. Well, I'd never told my mom, even before she even died, what really had happened. And because it would just crush her. You know, that was her dream, for me to really have a father, my own father, which she adored. And, you know, she would tell me all these wonderful things about him. I'm like, yeah, okay, well, that's going to happen. And, of course, it never did. You know, so about the same time when I was in that adoption deal, one of the party favors that was really convenient was a full bar of alcohol right there. Big house on the hill, He had a full bar. He entertained a lot. So booze and cigars. And I wouldn't say that I could drink as much as I want, but I certainly drank more than I was supposed to at that time. And and without realizing it, it would numb my feelings. It made the situation definitely palatable and even maybe even welcoming, because I could anesthetize myself to where I didn't have to feel anything again, you know. And it was better than daily ass beatings, you know, at the time. That's my thinking. And my disease progressed from there. So now I'm 13 and change and almost 14. My mom can't take me back. Social workers come and get me. Put me in a boys' home that lasted about 30 days. I ran away from there. I told my social worker, if you ever do that again, you'll never see me. That's a guarantee. And she didn't. She let me just kind of basically run wild. I lived with different friends in high school. I had found a new girlfriend there. Her mom was a hippie, one of the coolest people I've ever known. And she welcomed me into their home. There was always plenty of weed, occasional weekend parties. She dated a lot of very famous rock star and country stars. So money, weed, later on cocaine, it just wasn't a problem. So the feel-good stuff, man, it was very, very plentiful. And then I discovered that I could make a nice, tidy little cash income selling. Started off with weed and went to drugs after that, of all kinds, all sorts, at school. So school, which I was never interested in, became a permanent source of income. And where's the parties at? And they coincided with each other beautifully. And I'm fucking loaded all the time. God. Now I'm 14 and, man, fuck you, world. I'm down and I'm here. And I'm just like, now I got total freedom basically to do what I want. I met my social worker once a month at Carl's Jr. on Artesia Boulevard, and that was the agreement. And I did that almost just shy of my 18th birthday. And so that worked out kind of great, free as I, you know, could do. School, in and out of school. I can't say that I tried. I excelled in some things that I had interest of. History was one of them, surprisingly. That's fucking weird. But I liked history. I was never in class. It was a typical traditional study thing. Teacher would go back in, get his assignment. Me and my buddy John Crow, psh, out the door to his house. And we'd schedule our class where we had history, PE. So we out at history. PE, we don't dress out. We threaten the other kids. We're here, whoever, we're doing roll call. You better check us down. We beat the fuck out of you. And then we're out for lunch. So we get a good 2.5 window. And fuck, you know, after lunch, why are you going to bother going back to school? I feel good. There's no sense in it, you know. That went on for a while. So the last grade that I completed, if you want to call it that, I don't even really call it that, maybe ninth grade. And I think I got like 5 credits, one class, history. D-minus teacher said, dude, you could have got an A+, but you never turn in, I don't think, a single assignment. I got like A's and B's on all my tests because I would read the shit. And I get all stoned. I'm like, oh, dude, that's heavy duty, man. Christopher Columbus says in 1682. I love to read about that. And I discovered later that that helps also get me out of self. You know, I don't have to feel that thing. So that was an easy part. It progressed all the way through my teens and with debacles far ahead of my years. I mean, some very nasty, nasty people and some very dangerous situations that were, I do not know. Well, I believe God brought me through that. That's my only go-to that I can think of to this day. It was beyond anything crazy. Just the different situations that I allowed myself to get into. And those situations I allowed myself to get into, the driving force on that was my ability to get free anything I want. That's why I do what I want to do, because I got to feed me, you know. And I didn't realize that then, but that would set up a pattern of self abuse, ego. Fuck you, get away from me, put another block on my wall. Today I put a whole row of them up. You know, I don't need you. Goodbye, I'm good, good to go. And so any influence of anything good from that point, from anywhere, was not gonna even come close to getting over my wall. No way. And there was a lot of good people throughout my life, here and there, that tried to give me opportunities. Some of my friends' parents, it was a really wealthy neighborhood in the Beach City, and I had some of my friends' parents who were just absolute angels. And they had no idea I was the biggest shithead around. And because I was real cordial to them, and I became a super chameleon. And I had different groups of friends, once again, all to push my product. And I would go there, and it's just like, hey, man, what's up, you know? Came back in town, and it was that way. And then by the time you hit about 22, most of those doors had shut, solid closed, because the alcoholism in particular with alcohol had really progressed to a point to where I was extremely violent. You never know. Once I take that drink, I myself can't tell you what's going to happen, and so can nobody else. And it would go extremely bad really quick. So people with any kind of common sense, as my friends from high school started to get somewhat kind of sober and not progress down the disease road of alcoholism, had the common sense to cut me off from them. You know, and I was like kind of hurt a lot of times repeatedly. Well, fuck you, there's another opportunity over there. And so that was my deal, just bounce around, you know, keep searching for it. But as long as I got my best friend, my Baba, always can go to the Baba. Can't get dope, can't get pills, can't get whatever. I can go and walk in a fucking store any time of night or day, preferably 24-hour deal where they don't have a lock on the cage, and they didn't in those days. Walk down the aisle and crack a bottle in front of who I could give a shit who was ever watching. I just chug down whatever I want, put it on there, and look at you like you're stupid. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Call the cops. I don't give a fuck. You know? And that was my attitude in regards to my best friend. Don't even think about getting in the middle of that, because you're going to get hurt. Good chance of that. So, and that's how I would drive my life, you know, not knowing that. But all my actions, my thinking, everything revolved around feeding myself so I didn't have to feel. You know, the little intervals that I would get here and there with soberness where I'd have to start thinking or reflecting on something would just be way too much to handle. There is no way. And why? I got my best friend. Hello. Problem solved. The progression of the disease escalated. And sometimes very badly, very quickly. But it was always a fix. It was always over. And I got away with, I can't even tell you. I can't. And then I met my wife. I was 22. And at that point, I wanted absolutely nothing to do with a relationship with a female. I just want to hang out, screw you, and have a good day. Thank you. You got a sister. Or how about your mama? She's looking pretty good too. And that was my thinking, and that was my reality, you know, and I didn't see really anything wrong with it at all. Not at all. You know, what can I use you for? I don't care. What can I use you for? Go ahead, you can try to use me too. I don't give a shit. So met her. I was out dancing one night, it was the day after Thanksgiving, and I go down to the dance club because they had a nice little happy hour down there at the Red Onion, and where am I at on time? Oh shit, we're almost done. So, met my wife, and if you know my wife, she's like, this is God, hands down. I mean, I can't even, I don't even know. It's like, you're a sick fuck for even thinking, putting this together. What are you thinking, dude? Jesus Christ, this woman is complete and total opposite of me. And there's no doubt years ago that I realized that she completely started the change on my thinking. No question about it. I never thought about other people or your feelings or anything. It's not not only ever going to happen, but it's something I didn't even think that would exist or did exist. And I met her and I discovered a different way. I discovered that I had some feelings that I liked, you know, some honest, genuine feelings towards another individual that I could not possibly do anything wrong to, you know? I mean, you're dying if you're hurting my old lady. And so I cleared that path off, and, you know, I don't want any girlfriends, I don't want, sure as fuck, no wife, and kids, I don't think so, like kids, but not for me. And, I'd like to say things went well, but things went educationally acceptable with at the beginning of our relationship. It was a one-sided schooling because she was completely oblivious to my behaviors. The chameleon part of me came out, and all I did was put on a huge giant front for her. Here's Captain Wonderful, you know, things are good. Well, he doesn't work, but he's always got money and motorcycles and cars and got a house at the beach. And the fuck, this guy is 22, you know? And it was just great and wonderful, you know? And, but what I discovered was that other side, love, compassion, tolerance, the beginning of those and what they meant. Long story short, 5 daughters later, and recently, 32 years of marriage, and damn, dude, I would have lost my farm, your farm, on that bet. That was never even, not even. Like less than nothing of a thought, a possibility. Like, what are you talking about? That exists? Maybe for you. You know, and so when I was 29, I had really dug myself into a hole. I'd lost everything. And I'd built up quite a nice little nest egg, some companies, and everything was really good. That chameleon part, I want to get what I want. You got it. I'm getting it. That was always there, and I was pretty successful at doing that, and not in a really you know, mean, cruel way as far as the business goes, but very aggressive. And I just like it says in our book, you know, we build up our structures and we tear them down. And I, that was my first experience with that, and really knowing that. And my wife, one day I woke up from a nap. I'm 29 years old. Her and that, at that time, 3 children were gone. And my brother-in-law was like, I don't know, dude, she took off, because I'm not living it. I don't have a place anymore. I'm camped out in the garage of my sister's house. And still not with a clue. And by that time, my drug addiction, smoking the pipe, had gotten really bad, and it got really weird. Took about a year and a half. I went through all the money, and because I used to snort the shit out of everything. And it really wasn't too weird, but when I started smoking, it was a whole nother ball game. And then the booze, and that was beauty. Man, I could drink, fuck, dude, like a lot of booze. And I still function. I'm Mr. Function. Life is good, no problem. Well, when she left, that changed. So in my psychotic state, I had to steal the neighbor's lady bike. I know my father-in-law is behind all this, so I had to ride to LAX airport, hijack an airplane, and put it into his high-rise condo in Toronto. So that's the plan. That's where my mind went. And I mean, I'm on Reality Street there. That's what I'm doing. And I'm about halfway to the airport, and I'm thinking, damn, dude, you're you are really Looney Tunes. You're nuts. You're really crazy. You know, and I just stopped, and for the very first time in a very long time, I said an honest prayer that I actually meant. And it was very brief. It was probably something like, God, if you're out there, help me. You know, and I turned around, and I didn't stop in any particular place, but I turned around, and there's this big Catholic church there. I just happened to do that in front of between the golf course, the Laundry golf course, and that church. And I said, you know, I'm going to go to that Alana Club, because I remember those people were kind and loving. So there must be something there. Man, I can get some help from there. They're there to help people. So I went there, and I showed up, and I was just like, hey, yeah. And a meeting was just starting or something like that. The meeting ended. These three guys came out, had a bunch of time, old crusties, and they're talking. And I said, you know, can you? And they're talking about like going over to Bob's Big Boy to have something to eat. And I'm starving because I'm coming off of who many knows how many days. I ain't ate shit. I smell like shit. I got a backpack of some dirty clothes, a stolen bicycle, not a penny on me. And I'm like, can you guys give me enough money just to get a cheeseburger at McDonald's? And they kind of look at each other, a little smirk, and they say, no. Tomorrow morning at 6:45, there's a meeting here, and there's always donuts and coffee, so just show up tomorrow. And I was like, you motherfuckers. You're fucking motherfucker. Don't you know the state I'm in? I'll cut your throat. Take your car and blah. Right? That's my thinking. And this guy, John, about my same age, he says, hey, man, dude, you need a place to crash and some food, and you got, man, you can come to a sober living house. I stay there, you know. And I'm thinking, well, I ain't got anything else going on. Okay, it's getting dark. It's getting cold. It's December. So I go up to this place, and this guy, John Quinn, in trouble again, the director of the house, Super Squirrel, he goes, well, if you don't cause trouble, behave yourself, you can sleep on the couch for a couple weeks. You got to get a job. If you're even staying here on the couch, you got to go to at least two meetings a day, one in the morning for sure, ask the guys to get you there, whatever, ask around, put your hand out, get numbers, blah, blah, blah. Like, okay, yeah, sure. 2 weeks go by, no job, not even effort looking for one. But I was starting to get that laughter, you know. And so I kept a good morality in the house because, you know, it's a living house. And there was quite a few guys in there, and there's all kinds, it's a shit show. But I'd like joke about shit. And I just thought it was kind of funny, you know. And still, I'm just whacked in the head. So everything could be funny to me. So I got kicked out of there. We had 2.5 months, no job. They said, dude, we gotta let you go, man. And but I stayed sober for 5 years. And you know, I was doing okay. Kids and wife are back. Now I got 5 kids. Everything's beautiful. I got a little job painting houses and living at the beach again, right close to it. And life's pretty good. I am definitely right up there in the top 10 list of new guys poster child for Alcoholics Anonymous in my head. I'm doing what my sponsor tells me to do, and he is a Nazi. And, I mean, so I get the wild idea that it's too expensive to live down there. I can't live by the beach anymore. We sold the property we were in. We have to move inland. That's going to be $2,500 a month. I can't afford that. So I'm going to start looking around for a new place to go. So long story short, we discovered Orchid over here. Good schools, good everything. And I always fancied myself, you know, a financial genius. And so I thought, well, what's an easy way to make money? Always done it on other people's money. Shit, might as well sell the most expensive thing there is. So I'll do real estate. So I did that. Got my real estate license. I hit the market fucking right on time in the early 2000s. And did really well. And, you know, when I move up here, I'm 5 years sober. So I continue on my merry way. Meetings, first thing I did when we even visited here, I went to Ben Wiley over there, looked around. You motherfuckers are trash. You ain't like me. I'm not like you. Have a good day. And I continued to do that lack of action, of effort, of willingness to go to any meetings or have any contact with anybody or any spirituality or any prayer or any steps or any sponsorship for 7.5 years. And I reached a point one night, a guy thought he was going to put hands on one of my girls, and I went gunning for him. I was going to blow his head off. And thank God I didn't find him, you know, or I'd be in prison right now. Wrap it up. Okay. Well, shit, man. Wrap it up.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, more will be revealed. You know, for me, I get to keep coming back over long periods of relapse. You know, the love and acceptance around these rooms is something that I value and treasure, you know, really more than anything. And everything that, you know, is Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I can't say enough about these rooms and the people in here, you know. Thank you so much for having me, and have a good night.
Let's give Kevin another round, huh, and Jack? Thank you, Jack.